We are back again for another hour with some interesting discussions. And I want to introduce you to James Beaman. He is an actor, a writer, and has a different way of promoting, I think, a very healthy outlook on how to cope in our LGBT community. And I think it's a valuable piece of conversation to have. Xander Keeg, my co-host, will not be joining us today. We will miss Xander. Let's turn this over to James. James, welcome.
Thank you.
How did you even decide that this was a thing you needed to do?
You know, like most things that are non sequiturs of life, it came to me. I've learned to follow my gut. And this is one of the things that I'm preaching a lot these days to young people. They don't know how to trust their inner intuition and their feelings about things. They don't trust their own feelings about things. They seem to be hyper aware of their feelings, but really they're not in tune with their own instinct, their strength inside that tells them whether it feels good or not. So it happened to me, and I felt like a weird, different kind of an experience. And as an artist, as a theater artist, I felt there weren't enough voices of people going, wait a minute. And the voices that there were are wonderful voices, but they're people who've been canceled. They've already been canceled. And they're on the other side of that, trying to get their voice out. And I haven't, to my knowledge, been canceled yet. So I'm an actor. I've been an actor for 33 years professionally in the theater. I've been in New York for 3 decades pursuing theater. And I grew up in theater. My parents met in the 50s in theater school. My father was a set designer and my mother was a playwright and a director and actor. So it was the family business. So I've been doing this my whole life. And of course, as I'm sure you know, and it was a global thing, but certainly over here, every kind of live gathering was shut down during COVID, and we had 100% unemployment in the professional theater. I mean, basically nil. And I was living a very difficult period of my life, as I think many of us did during that time. I can expound on that, but it's a lot. But I went through some just kind of life-changing things that can happen to people in their 50s that happen to you. And there are these passages of life that are profound. And it all kind of happened at the same time while in lockdown. So this sort of intense experience of life just kind of coming for me and my own mortality and having to face those kinds of things, big, profound things. So last summer, I came back for the first time in, it was at that point, 29 months since I'd been in a play. I was in a play when lockdown happened in March of 2020. I was playing the lead in La Cage aux Folles in this gorgeous production down in Florida. So it had been a while since I went back, and I went back to do a show I'd already done. Lovely part at a theater I've done 5 shows at that was in my hometown. My mother passed away last spring. And so 2 weeks after we did her memorial up in Massachusetts, where I'm from, I was able to go back and really spend time with my nieces and nephew and my family up there, my extended family. And so I'm like, okay, this will be great. And I walked into the rehearsal process for this show feeling like I'm back in my element. This is great. And as I have told the story a couple of other places, the long and the short of it is that part of this show, it was a very racially diverse cast, as it needed to be. It was a jukebox musical dealing with the different musical styles of the 50s. But there was a scene of racial tension in the play, and certain elements in this company of actors chose that moment to turn it into a teaching moment, which really was kind of like a psychological abuse moment where they beat up on a white actress in the cast and just really went after her in a way that you just don't do this in theater. And I had never witnessed any of this before. I had not read Kendi. I had not read D'Angelo. I really didn't know. I knew about BLM. I was so supportive. I have to be supportive of anything that makes humanity better and increases our connection to each other as human beings. So that's not even a question. But this ritualistic demonstration is really what it was around a sort of issue of race was very, very disturbing. And I sort of pushed back against it because I didn't know that my job, and I've said this on another podcast with my friend John McWhorter and Glenn Lowry, I didn't know my job as a white man was to be quiet. I wasn't aware that I wasn't allowed an opinion about something that was really causing incredible disruption in the process of making this work. Long and short of it is, it got directed back at me. It was very unpleasant. I was very upset and disturbed by it because it was bullying. And I've experienced that in my life to an intense, intense degree early in my development. Talk about, I hate the word trigger, but that's the trigger for me. And I started speaking out about it. I was like, what the hell is going on here? No one told me that I was going to be part of an experiment or that I was going to need to be taught a lesson about my white supremacy in the workplace by fellow performers. There's a protocol. There's a reason our work is very intimate. The work of making theater, we have to be right on top of each other. We live together in regional theater. We drive to and from work together. We do grocery shopping trips with strangers that you just met. And it's part of the deal that we make it work because we focus on the work that we're there to do. This crossed all kinds of boundaries for me. And as fate would have it, my Simon's Rock roommate, I went to Simon's Rock, which I don't know if anybody over in your listening audience knows, it's an early entry college. It was an experiment that Bard College did in the 60s that turned into a wonderful two-year, sometimes for some people, four-year college experience for high school age students. And it rescued me from a very abusive situation in public school when I was 15.
The listeners are from all over the world, primarily UK and India, in addition to the US. So no, this is a good thing.
Oh, great, great. Well, I was lucky that this school existed because it was sort of for sort of intellectually and artistically advanced sort of misfits. And John McWhorter, who many of your listeners probably know, he's a best-selling author. He's got a New York Times newsletter. He teaches linguistics at Columbia, and he wrote a book called Woke Racism, which has really thrust him into the mainstream. And of course, while that was happening, I had this experience last summer, and John and I were roommates at 16 years old at Simon's Rock. We were teenage kids together way long ago. And I went, okay, tell me what is happening. And John educated me. And the more I thought about it, and the more I found out about people in my industry, in the theater industry, who had been completely obliterated for thinking the wrong thing or not wanting to get COVID vaccinated, which I have different opinions about that. I'm not defending that because unit cohesion is part of the dealio. And people were scared and freaked out. We have a long period of healing from these lockdowns. I don't need to tell you. I'm not qualified to diagnose, but I think we all know that we are broken and we haven't had the time to heal from any of this. And we've taken action instead on our passions, on our resentments, on our fear. And people aren't thinking clearly. I'm thinking clearly. And as far as the LGBTQIA, RESPECT, find out what it means to me community, I think you and I can both agree that to a degree, the community, and I'm putting up these little quotation marks with my fingers, is kind of a myth, but it wasn't always. And I don't know about you. I'm not going to ask you to give your age, but I'm a Gen Xer. I came out in 1984. I think people of my generation and older have a certain experience of what it was like to be in a culture where we were not allowed to be in our truth, in our life. And there were consequences for that. And politically, it was a political thing to be out. You basically were like, well, maybe I won't get to work. You know, I had teachers I went to an elite conservatory theater program in Boston because my father taught there. My brother went to the same university, but he was a smart one. He went for computer engineering and ended up working for Apple for 30 years. Bless him. Smart man, didn't go into the family business. But anyway, I'm at this school, I'm studying acting, and I'm being told by gay teachers, if you don't butch it up, if you don't hide your gayness, you're not going to have a career. Gay teachers telling me this. And I had been bullied from the time I was in first grade. As a small child growing up in the suburbs of Boston, which were Irish and Italian, Catholic, working class people who had come up to middle class and bought houses in the suburbs. And my parents were bohemians. We were mixed faith household. I was Jewish. I had an adopted younger sister who was adopted at 6 months, who was Black. I mean, talk about the perfect storm of weirdness in the 1970s, growing up as that kid. I was picked on relentlessly in school. I was sexualized very young, and that coming back from that, or at least being able to walk beside that in my life and recognize the impacts of that, has been a long road. But this is part of what I'm here to say, since you asked me. As soon as I said something about something that, it's one of those things where we all see the obvious and no one is saying anything. And I'm being told that I don't have the right to have an opinion about what's happening in my industry, which was almost decimated by COVID and is limping back. That I've done my whole life, given up stability, I've given up owning a home, I made my ex side gazint, I'm living on the edge to be able to do the work that I do. And I'm told I'm not allowed to have an opinion about the work. I'm not allowed to have an opinion of where the industry is going. I'm not allowed to push back at some of the things that are happening within my own performing union that we're not voting on, that there's no consensus about. There's a great deal of stuff going on. And people are afraid to talk about it. And telling the truth should not be something that you're afraid of. I'm not on Twitter, haven't been for years, and I'm not on TikTok, because what would I be doing there? So I'm not in the hornet's nest where people have lost perspective of the fact that they're dealing with other human beings. I'm not in that. So maybe I'm being a little bit cavalier, but honestly, it makes less sense to me not to speak my truth. The other thing is I feel a responsibility as a Gen Xer. I'm 50, be 58 years old in October. And a friend of mine recently coined this thing for me. And she really, it imprinted on me. She said, Gen Xers, we had analog childhoods and digital adulthoods. So we were pre-computers and the internet and post to the point where we're literate in the tech. So we had four channels on television when I was a child. We collected records and played LPs, and I acted out musicals in my bedroom. I wished to be Stephanie Mills in The Wiz. I played that album so much it had to be replaced. You know, if we wanted to read a book and we wanted to know something, we had to write a book report, we had to write a history paper, we went to the library. We had to seek it out. We had to find it and absorb it. In the summer times, we had Mobile. I read everything. I checked all of my little books off my reading list for the summer. I mean, we went after our knowledge. We were the original latchkey kids. We had to be independent. My mother kicked my dad out when I was 10, 12, and worked three jobs. So I had to get myself up in the morning. I had to make lunches for my younger sister. I had to come home and do my homework and set the table. I was impacted by AIDS. I was lucky to be of the generation where I became a hypochondriac and completely repressed sexually in my early 20s in college, but I was very out and vocal as an activist and marched on Washington and joined ACT UP and did that. When people say you're picking on the Zoomers too much, first of all, if they don't know what that feels like, if they don't know loving, tough love, that kind of medicine, of girl, sit down, you need to be read. They're missing something, and I'm happy to provide it because it's love. It's love. And the reason that I get impatient with the community is because it doesn't mean anything anymore. It's a catch-all. It's a sink drain for identities that are not straight, anything but straight. And I worry about kids, because they want to push back against convention, but they want to turn the things that made us subversive and outrageous and into something mundane. Why are you taking something that makes you special and different, wearing it, literally wearing it? I mean, I dyed my hair pink in the 80s too, kids. You didn't invent it. But to everything, there is a season. Everything, there is a season. But grow up. After a certain point, stop screaming about the community and how people are being hurt, because the trans people in my life are too busy doing amazing things to be screaming about their pronouns. They're leaders, they're icons, they're activists, they're artists, they're rule breakers, they're inspirers, and they're in their 40s, 50s, 60s.
When you covered the terrain of these magnificent performers who were queer, and yes, we're not protected as a result of that. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, I got a little feisty. Here's the thing. I like bringing the sass because it punctures this kind of false piety, this false kind of dignity around this conversation, and injects humor, a kind of humor that is the survival instinct for queer people of all kinds. We need it. That's our armor. That's our flaming sword, is our ability to puncture stuff with humor and to own our own weirdness, right? So this meme was going around, and it was this collage of icons, pop icons from the 80s. And it was Boy George and Grace Jones and Prince and Annie Lennox. And the captain said, I don't understand why older people are so confused about gender identity when these were their pop icons. And I went, okay, now you need to be read. I saw that and I went, okay, girl, you don't even know what you're freaking talking about. So I wrote this essay, it's called Bitch Please. And it's gotten quite a little bit of attention. I mean, everything's a little bit of attention because I just started my Substack recently. But what it is it's like, it's gay people, gay LGBTQ people. Beyond that, I don't know. I'm insecure about beyond that. But that makes sense because we banded together at a time for a reason. You know, I don't have to tell anybody listening that the agendas of gay men and lesbians traditionally have been very different. Not exactly the same. My friend Quentin Crisp, who I mentioned in this essay that you cite, who was really a hero of mine. He was really a hero. He was an eccentric man, but quite a brilliant wit, raconteur. And somebody asked him once what the difference was between gay men and lesbians. And he said, well, gay men just want to be happy and lesbians just want to be right. Which I thought kind of nailed it. But anyway, I'm bashing the community today, but I will get there. I'm also a Jew and I was brought up by a first generation American who grew up in Flatbush, Brooklyn and experienced New York in the 40s, 50s with Yiddish in the household and all that. We were taught never forget. Plus jamais. Never forget our history. Never forget the times where we've let our guard down, when we've pursued less than healthy. You know, have you seen Leopoldstadt? Ooh, well, it's on Broadway now. I'm sure it's been in the West End, or it is in the West End. It's about that. It's about these upper middle class people in Berlin at the turn of the last century, and they're a Jewish family and they're putting up a Christmas tree because they're Berliners. They're not Jews first, right? And of course, the war comes and all of these terrible things happen. But what I was taught as a Jew was don't forget. Don't forget the history. Learn from the history. Embrace it. Own it. Never forget. It's not that you walk around in resentment all the time. You just remember where you came from so that it never happens again. So that the Holocaust or atrocities, like my great-grandmother escaped the pogroms in Kishinev, which they've just had the 120th anniversary of that slaughter. She was 15 years old, hid in a sewer while her village was being destroyed. So you don't carry that with you. What you do is you let it inform you. Because knowledge, you know, as Auntie Mame said to Mr. Babcock in the movie of Auntie Mame, Mr. Babcock, knowledge is power. And that is the truth. And so these young gay people, young queer people, young gender non-binary, whatever you want to be, you didn't invent it. You're making it very, very confusing and difficult to take you seriously. There's a whole sort of galaxy of these avatar types that I call the Teletubbies, but they need to know what LGBT was and why. They need to understand that people banded together because it took Matthew Shepard in America for people to wake up after years of people dying, after the Reagan administration failing on every possible front, some might say by design, to help our community, everybody banding together. Show business, I mean, the history of my union, Actors Equity Association, with coming to the aid of its people who were suffering, who were dying, were ill. It's a brilliant thing that happened around something tragic. But it took Matthew Shepard, it took Ryan White. If people remember, Ryan White was the first child to get HIV. Ellen DeGeneres's rise back from beach, talk about cancellation. She came out on her show, she was destroyed. And she came back because she had nothing left to lose. And she's like, Matthew Shepard, this cannot happen. This cannot happen in America, right? So I understand the activism. I do. And I am supportive of it. But know what you're fighting for.
We're going to take a short break, even if we accept the possibility of some 73 different genders. The simple male or female alternatives provide an abundance of health issues that justify our care and attention. From cradle to grave, from fertility to menopause, from the universal desire to make a positive difference to the individual desire not to disappear without a trace. Once a taboo topic, mental health, at last, this vital area is getting the attention it deserves. We are all products of our background. The challenge is how we avoid becoming victims of our history.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Apples and pears, beef and skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Dec, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com.
Strawberries and cream.
Once upon a time, human slavery was just a fact of life. Right now, animal abuse is often considered normal. In time, it won't be. Animal Aid campaigns peacefully against all forms of animal abuse and promotes cruelty-free living.
Check out animalaid.org.uk. It's time for a kinder world.
The station that makes you feel good.
James, what is your message to youth?
Be grateful for what you have. There's no sin in that. There's no sin in looking at the generations that came before you. And I say this to my youngins all the time when they listen to me. I say to them, look, I was born in 1965. Stonewall, which many see as being the sort of seminal moment when the gay rights movement took off, it was not the beginning, but it certainly was this and still is this seminal moment. That was 69. I'm not old. I'm oldish, but I'm not old. So that means the entire gay rights movement has happened during my lifetime. And the fact that some of these kids can't take their little device and pull up something on the Google, read the Cliff's Notes from Eric Marcus's beautiful book, Making History, or read it in an afternoon. It's in paperback edition. I'll lend it to you. You know, it's like, know what you're fighting against and fighting for, and understand when you say you're queer, who fought for you to say that? Queer was something we took back in the 80s. Right? We're here. We're queer. Get used to it. It was an epithet. It was something thrown at us. It's similar to another word in a different culture that has become radioactive. But this word has become, again, it's a catch-all. For what? Young women, young cisgender women who are confused about their bodies, don't understand their sexuality, are for shame, full of shame, who are buying into this white oppressor thing and want to do anything to be different, anything to be not a white girl, a straight white girl. And I'm saying this with respect. I understand it, right? This musical called The Fantastics. I'm sure people now, you know, try to remember. It's this old musical, right? And this young ingenue, this one girl in the show, Louisa. Louisa has this monologue at the beginning that leads into her song Much More. And she's talking about her imagination and how she's all these different things in her imagination. And she, at the end of it, she says, please, God, please don't let me be normal. And what I'm seeing around me is you don't want to be in the white oppressor hated group of white supremacy. So you don't shave your armpits, you dye your hair pink, get a septum piercing and call yourself non-binary in some cases. And I think where I'm really upset in the conversation is there's a big difference between drag and being trans, but they're being mushed together by a bunch of ignorant people who are using this as a cudgel because there's a presidential election coming up. I am not here to insult non-binary people, by the way. Okay. I don't spend a lot of time giving disclaimers and apologizing because if people are going to hate you, they're going to hate you. I love young people. who are creative and who are passionate. We have to give people permission, especially little kids, permission to express gender, to explore gender expression without going to the altar quite so soon in your decision about what you're going to be. And I think, well, I don't have to tell you, again, you know who you are inside. You know the truth of who you are. How you get there and what you do to step into that, as you well know, that is a personal thing. And it can't be picked up by a bunch of yoga pant wearing, Graco stroller pushing, upper middle class white suburban moms who are bored. Because when I was a child, you know, I was a little gay boy. I was like poster child. I was teeny tiny with curly blonde hair like a cherub with big blue eyes. And I was precocious and I was a performer from very young. And I was little and asthmatic and read books and played with dolls. But I wasn't a girl. I was a girly boy. That's the other thing. Guys, it's okay to be a sissy. It's okay to be a twink. It's okay to be a sissy. If you want to be a sissy, it's okay to be a dyke. It really is okay to not fit a particular idea of masculinity or femininity, but you can't be who you are in resistance to an idea. You have to be it. Be it.
What is your message to parents?
Well, and I think that this is one of the reasons why there's so much passion from certain parents towards wanting to affirm something really, really like fast and really, they want to be on the right side of things, I think. But what they're overcorrecting, I think, and I'm not a psychologist, I'm a student of human nature. Let's put it that way. There's got to be disappointment in you as a parent if your boy isn't a boy as you hoped or thought, or you have to grieve that. You have to own that you created a life and cloaked it in dreams and hopes and aspirations. Why not? That's why you have a child, right? But if you bypass those legitimate feelings because you are self-censoring in fear of people thinking that you're a terrible human being, you can't be in the truth. And you're going to start concocting stuff. And your child just wants attention. This is my message to kids. You know, I did an essay about free to be you and me. And I don't know in other countries and other cultures if people know it. I've got to by now. But it was Marlo Thomas was part of this Gloria Steinem Ms. Foundation and Ms. Magazine and all of this feminist sort of stuff in the 70s and educating kids on being okay with being different kinds of boys and girls. And it was a TV show and it was a record album that I played until my mother wanted to shoot me. It was all about you can be your kind of boy and I can be my kind of girl and it's okay to be who you are. And I needed that, you know, I really needed that. But I see parents today. They're looking at each other. And I'm going to say this, and you know, I've already probably dug a big hole. I don't know what I've said in the past 20 minutes, but I probably already have people up, you know, up in arms against me. But here's something I'm going to say about women, cisgender, heterosexual, primarily women, particularly white ones. I worked in cosmetics for 15 years in high-end retail in the 90s and early 2000s in New York. Hundreds of clients, hundreds of makeup applications. High-end, wealthy, wealthy, wealthy people. I know what women do to each other. I've seen it. Women don't get plastic surgery for men, and they don't get it for themselves, and they don't get their hair done for men, and they don't do it for themselves. Women are very, very hard on each other, and they're very critical of each other, and it's too bad that that is the case, because I think women are getting a raw deal right now. I really do. I think men are getting a raw deal right now, too, by the way. I guess there's an inevitability to some of that.
Talk to us about Substack. Why is this the way to go now?
I've been publishing 2 posts a week for the past 6 weeks. Substack is a fascinating thing, and I was introduced to it by John McWhorter and Glenn Lowry. Glenn has something called The Glenn Show, which is his podcast, but it's connected with Substack. So Substack is kind of like a home base, self-published, subscriber-driven content. It is not censored. It is not managed. You're responsible for what you write, what you post. You can support each other. You find other writers on there. You subscribe to them. You can subscribe to things for free. You can become monthly. I throw $5-6 at people every month to support what they're doing. And you can connect a podcast to it. Now, the podcast thing was the thing I was going to do first because I had had this conversation with John and Glenn last year, which people can see on YouTube if you look it up. I think the headline on it is, it's the Glenn Show, G-L-E-N-N. And I think the episode is called Spotlighting Wokeness. And it's a peek behind the anti-racist curtain. It's had like 30,000 views. And I've been hearing from people in the industry secretly, quietly, saying thank you for saying something. I am not anti-woke. This is something, first of all, woke is a posture. Woke is a pose to me, adhering to a certain kind of language and to a certain kind of ideology and to us and making very, very rigid opinions about certain things and not deviating from that and squashing anything that doesn't fit. I liken it to the temperance movement in the early part of the 20th century in America. And it's an interesting time because we were just coming out of the First World War, we're talking around 1918, 1919. Coming out of the war, massive casualties, massive loss of life. In the midst of all of this, there are these women trying to keep down the home front, and there's the flu epidemic. Everything shut down, just like we were, not quite as long, but yeah, and people are dying of the flu, women and children. Out of this, with these men returning, these shattered men returning from war, there's a growing alcoholism problem, right? And these temperance reformers who'd been there for 100 years, but with this fringe element, step out there with their sign, they're going, the demon drink. Let's get rid of this stuff. It's breaking up the home. It's destroying our husbands and fathers, and it's leading to all kinds of moral depravity. And that went nuclear, and it no longer became just about alcohol. It became about all kinds of moral deviancy, and people were reporting on their neighbors, and shop owners were being outed for being alcoholics and cheating on their wives. And it was vicious, and it led to prohibition. And prohibition did more to support alcoholism and to foster organized crime in the United States than anything had prior to that time. And it was all because a group of people decided we are the moral authority and we will destroy all those who are not. I said to somebody yesterday, I direct solo performers of all types and in cabaret and elsewhere. And I was talking with a new client of mine yesterday about this stuff. And I said, he's a little bit more lefty than I am. And he's like, well, you know, there's collateral damage in every war. I said, there's no war. And I decide if I'm going to be damaged. If I'm going to make, I've made plenty of sacrifices for my work. If I'm going to make a sacrifice, I'm going to make it. You don't get to decide what I do. And I said to him, and just remember this while you're feeling good about yourself and clutching your pearls. Back in England, when Charles I got his head chopped off and the Protestant Reformation happened, the theater disappeared for 18 years. The theater in England disappeared for 18 years. And it didn't come back until the Restoration because the king's girlfriend was an actress. And it introduced women to the British stage for the first time. So that was an innovation, but it took almost two decades to come back from this censoriousness and moral judgment and shutting things down that don't fit with this narrow view. This is the other thing. Somebody said to me recently, you're so courageous to blah, blah, blah. I'm like, telling the truth should not be an act of courage. Telling the truth as you know it, based on experience. There's a lot of talk about experience. Lived and otherwise. I've been there. So have you, right? Am I wrong? And it's our time to say, no, 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 no. I'm still here. I'm not retired. I'm not living in the condos. I'm not in assisted living. I'm still here. And you need to hear what I have to say. It's okay if everything right now is celebrating diversity. It should. This is the other thing. People think that I'm just complaining because I'm this old white actor and now I can't get a job. Nobody gets a job. People don't understand. In England, theater is part of its tourism. And it's supported by the government. Over here, there are 51,000 members of Actors' Equity Association, which includes professional stage managers and actors, 51,000 dues-paying active members. Of that 51,000, in any given week, 6% are working. 3,500 people are working in the American theater.
What happened?
Television and then movies and then... And I'm worried. I'm not going to lie. I'm worried because the people who are supporting theater right now, who are passionate about it, are boomers who are getting up there. And they're not going to be here forever. And this is another problem I have with the social justice, the DEI stuff coming in and trying to cookie cutter the theater into its template of what it, the hierarchy, the great chain of suffering is what I call it, that they've decided. I don't think 70-year-old women who came in on a walker and buy a yearly subscription and donate to the theater need to sit through a land acknowledgement before they watch a tap dancing show. Unless you're going to do something about it. Unless you're going to take up a collection for the Native American tribes and their ancestors who once owned the land upon which the theater sits. Unless you're going to do something. All you're doing is being a scold. And all of this stuff is being foisted upon producers to do. You will do this. We are watching. Of course, Native American people have been marginalized. I will point out to my brethren in the show business, if there's anyone listening, they created this acronym of BIPOC, right? Black, Indigenous, People of Color. And it's funny because one of my best friends is in England and she was reading one of my essays where I mentioned BIPOC. She's like, what is that? I'm like, well, you don't have that over there. But it's a hierarchy of suffering. Black people get the goodies first, then the Indigenous people because their land was taken away from them. And then everyone else, not white, gets to be in that little sink drain. Isn't that nice? And lately, Asian people count as white because they've done their homework and they're better at math and science. I mean, come on. But the Indigenous people, I don't see great visibility in film, television, media. I don't see Broadway shows about the Navajo or the Cherokee. I don't see that. I saw this Canadian television show called White Pines, which is fabulous, with Alfred Molina. And it deals with Canadian, this sort of history of genocide and it's all woven into this murder mystery thing. It's fabulous writing, great, great series. But that's it. So what good are you doing to lecture people who are there to support the thing that gives them joy in their golden years? What are you trying to achieve except to stand there in judgment of other people? Put your money where your mouth is.
Are you even able to change the direction that theater has taken?
It's not up to me. I personally think that what's happening in terms of visibility, diversity, experimentation, non-traditional casting, all of these things, some of them are good and land, and some of them feel like contorted. But the fact that it's happening is, no one is giving it a greater applause than me, because it reminds me of what happened after the AIDS, the worst of the AIDS pandemic. When I moved to New York in 1993, we were having what I call the gay 90s. Everything, I was in an off-Broadway gay review called Whoop-Dee-Doo. Angels in America was on Broadway, Kiss of the Spider Woman, Love, Valor, Compassion, everything off-Broadway. There was this huge drag scene. We had Wigstock, all of this gay culture. It was mainstream. It was celebrated. Tony Kushner won the Pulitzer Prize. It was what art does in response to national trauma. And we're seeing it in the wake of George Floyd. And we're seeing it happening on all levels, because there's always going to be a good result for a lot of this stuff. What I'm trying to push back against is when things cross the line, and it's not about the work anymore. It's about people being hypervigilant of each other and correcting each other and reporting each other. I mean, Actors Equity is putting together disciplinary panels of volunteers that are going to be a particular racial and gender makeup. And all of them have to do a DEI training and undergo unconscious bias assessment. What are these panels going to be for, do you think? It's going to be about struggle sessions for fellow members. And when I tell you earlier that 6% of this union works, really? People come in to do the thing that they are eating their heart out to do. I have 3 degrees in theater. And I live in Section 8 housing. You know, it's like, guys, we have power in the arts to show people our common humanity. And all you want to do is tear us apart. That's all you want to do. For what? You come into a theater space to play a role in a play. And your own identity is so important to you that you're constantly vigilant of how, if someone's misgendered you or somebody's said something that you see as a microaggression, how are you in your part? How are you serving your role? How are you serving the play, the work, your employer, who you see as white supremacist while he writes your check? Uh-uh. We're better than that. This is why. This is the long answer. This is my loquacious, logorrheic answer to your question. This is why.
We're going to take another break. We'll be back shortly.
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
Animal Aid campaigns peacefully against all forms of animal abuse and promotes cruelty-free living. We've been doing this for over 40 years. Every year, more and more people are living satisfying lives completely cruelty-free. Check out animalaid.org.uk. It's time for a kinder world.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
We're back from second break. Let's pick up where James left off.
Because it's too much and it's not right and you'll regret it. And the problem with it is the people who should regret it, and I'm all for the fever. We're in the fever. It's going to break soon. And we're all looking around. We're going to have to see whether, because this is still America, we're going to have to see whether some of these experiments in the theater are going to pay. We're seeing a lot of pushback on the road. There was a recent revival of Oklahoma directed by Daniel Fish that was very edgy. It was very diverse casting. Ali Stroker, wonderful musical theater performer, who is disabled, wheelchair user, won the Tony Award playing Ado Annie in Oklahoma. But that production is doing something to a treasured American musical on purpose. And there are people out in the greater United States who are offended by it. And they're walking out and they're canceling their subscriptions. Some of this stuff is not going to be commercially viable and people are going to have to start backpedaling a little bit. But the thing that people are kidding themselves about, my friends who are on council, elected council members of the union who are speaking to me in secret while these things happen, I will say to you, it's not going to go away unless people start going, you know, I don't think we need to treat each other like this. I think this is bad. And I think when we start the sensitivity readers, it's only a matter of time. They're starting with children's books, old British children's books. It's only a matter of time before they get to Shakespeare and Shaw and everyone else. And then they go back to the movies. And I'm an old movie fanatic. I know about you, but I'm a cinephile through and through. They'll start burning the prints of films that offend them or burying them in a vault so that no one can see them. I'm not saying this to be reactionary or melodramatic. What I'm saying is it's a bottomless pit. You start decolonializing everything. Theater traditionally in America has been a white pastime. And it's not always because Black people weren't allowed. It's been 100 years since Ethel Waters first integrated Broadway. There's been progress. There's been some. But instead of building new audiences in the LGBTQIA plus world, not just pandering to them, but actually getting people interested in live theater and the way that it brings all of us together in our common humanity. It's not just about going, well, now we have to cast a trans person in this role. Now we have to cast a Black person in this role. How about casting a great actor? I mean, when Morgan Freeman is getting shit for saying, I am not a Black actor, I'm an actor, Morgan Freeman is God, as far as most of us are concerned. We have to stop, and we have to be willing to stop now, because hubris is a terrible thing, particularly for artists. We don't go into this because we have tiny little egos that don't need external validation. You know, if you're too vicious with it, when things start to swing back, you're not going to be able to say, okay, I was wrong about that. You're not going to be able to be forgiving to yourself and to other people, because you'll have gone too far and your ego and your vanity will not allow. And that's when people get hurt. That's what happened in Nuremberg, when people get silent.
I have a tough question for you.
Okay, please. I seem to be able to answer everything in long form, but...
Have you lost friends? Have you lost valuable friendships?
Not that I'm aware of, but it's early days. I don't know. My Facebook friends have stayed steady, but I don't post about this stuff on Facebook as many, some people might. We were talking about Substack earlier. Substack really is a place where you can express yourself and find an audience. And there are some great people on there, Constantine Kisten and Barry Weiss and all the people at Fair. They're doing great work. There's everything for everybody. There's recipes. There's all kinds of things on there. But it's an alternative. I feel a little bit like a revolutionary in a basement, you know, printing leaflets. But the point is, if I do lose friends, they're not friends. Because here's the deal. People know me. They know I'm not a racist. They know I'm not a homophobe. I am not a transphobe. It just asks, oh my gosh. I'm a writer as well. And one of the things that makes me upset about the censoriousness of this movement is they're telling people, you can't write a character who's not what you are. So I'm not allowed to write a Black character. I'm not allowed to write a trans character. Too late. My survival project when I was living through COVID lockdown while taking care of my mother who had Alzheimer's dementia in a bubble. It was the hardest time of my life. I channeled that energy into 6 episodes of a series, a dramedy series. It's kind of tart. It's kind of dark comedy, but it's this is what it's about. It's about people who've had damage in their lives and are now middle-aged, and they're confronted with the person who did a lot of the damage, who now has dementia and doesn't remember what she did to you, and you've got to deal with it. And it's about generational dysphoria and how we come together and forgive each other, forgiveness. And I wrote a character who is based on and was written for a friend of mine named Lena Bradford, who is this great DJ and trans icon and goddess. And I wrote this part for her, and she mentored me about her journey. And I sent her pages and I said, am I honoring your experience? Am I telling this woman's story right? Am I representing you the way I feel about you? Is that coming through? And she did the first reading of it. And she's been helping me shop it around. But just me saying that I have a close friend who's trans, who mentored me in writing a role for a trans person, in some people's eyes makes me a transphobe. Like talking about my sister, this is what started this whole thing off. I'm in this conversation with this group of activists who were supposed to be there as actors last summer. And I said, I had a Black sister. I have 2 Black nieces and a Black nephew. They're my family. They're my family. And one of these people said, you didn't have to bring up your sister. Like, said, don't use your sister as a prop. So this is why I'm saying what I'm saying on. It's because you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't. They hate you already. The people who hate you already. They've made up their minds and they're just waiting for you to put a foot wrong. So if I lose friends for that reason, bye.
Yeah, I think it's really unfortunate that it's come to that.
It shouldn't.
But I think we are in a sort of a time bomb. That's how I would describe it. We have been attacking each other and not listening. It's all about me, 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 hear me, hear me. And my way or the highway.
More likes.
Yeah. Possibly people would disagree with me on this, and that's fine. But my parents grew up in South Africa, and they did not necessarily grow up with apartheid, or it wasn't really heightened until the 60s, even though it was certainly happening way before that. Yeah. But we were already living in Europe at this time. And what my mother would say is that apartheid was terrible. I had an uncle who worked the underground. He was a pharmacist. Apartheid was definitely about racism. It has its origins in South Africa. However, it's always existed, certainly with Hitler.
It's also driven by certain forces, and we don't talk about them enough. It's seen as too cynical to go there. But the fact of the matter is, Adolf Hitler showed up at a time of incredible poverty, the decimation of the German underclass. People were angry, they were upset. And this is what happens with every revolution. You've got a charismatic leader saying, we're going to take some of this, we're going to take stuff from the rich people, or we're going to bring down the bourgeoisie, or we're going to behead the king, or we're going to behead the queen and give you back. And what ends up happening is you're just as poor, and you're spending all your time reporting to the Stasi about your neighbor and what they said and what they did and what time they came in last night. And you're reporting on each other. And while you're doing that, the oligarchs are puffing their cigars. This is, we've got an election coming up. People know it. They've known it. That's why so much of this DEI stuff and so many other things on the right Trojan horse themselves into our institutions during COVID lockdown. It was the perfect time to do it. No one's paying attention. And then the perfect storm and George Floyd and that atrocity, that horrible, horrible thing. And what it brought out of people and was magnified by the lockdown. I get why, but ultimately, people really do want free speech. You can say you don't. And the youngins can say hashtag tear down capitalism. Those children would not like communism.
We have come to the end of our hour. Thank you for joining us. We will pick up again with James Beeman further down the road. In the meantime, please tune in to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Key. Thank you for listening.